Arab Talk. You're listening to Arab Talk on KPOO 89.5 FM. And again, our phone number is 346-5376. If you feel like talking, give us a call. With us here in the house, back from occupied Palestine from the Gaza Strip, is Dr. Jess Ghannam, who we're happy to see. He spent a week in Gaza, went at a time. Well, I don't think there is any good time. You know, it's
not
always,
really. It happened to be particularly bad when I was there, but it's not like there's ever a good time.
You know, when I was speaking with you on the phone, I can hear the bullets and the rockets.
It was nonstop, Jamal. I mean, that's the thing that I don't think our listeners truly understand, is that because there's a corporatization of the media and the news that's coming from Palestine, and a complete distortion and misrepresentation of what's happening there, when you actually see and hear and feel the reality, especially in Gaza right now, it is unbelievable. For the entire time I was there, there was 24/7 shelling. I mean, there are tanks. As I'm coming into Gaza from the Erez crossing.
How many people crossed with you?
How many people? I'll put it this way. When I got to the checkpoint in Erez, the Israeli soldiers were freaked out that there was another human being trying to get into the Gaza Strip. No one was going in and no one was leaving, which is tragic in itself. We'll get to that a little bit later because of all the Palestinians who are being denied medical attention. But, yeah, it's not like there was a mad rush of people going into Gaza. But as I was going – just to finish this really quick – as I was going into Gaza from the Erez crossing, you know, 20 or 30 tanks there.
If people don't go there, people don't bear witness.
You have to bear witness. And as I said, if you actually do go there and bear witness, you will get a – perspective and an analysis of what's happening in Palestine that obviously you won't get anywhere else. And we, you know, we're lucky that you and I have been there a lot. We are able to come back and tell these stories and bear witness to the atrocities that are being committed. You know, not just in the name of the occupying Israeli army that happens to be there, but also because of the American financial and political support that is extending this occupation in brutal ways. I mean, again, if Americans actually knew where their tax dollars were going and what that money was doing to brutally suppress an indigenous people, I think people would be throwing up their arms, especially when you hear about all the, you know, all the changes, you know, all the decreases in healthcare, all the decreases in education, and all the money that's being sent over to support these military actions in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in Palestine. It's simply outrageous.
So, you, in comparison to the last time, when were you there last?
November. So it's only been 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 or 5 months since I went before.
Okay, you said something major difference.
The major difference, Jamal, and I was kind of shocked because, you know, I go pretty frequently, and the major difference is the significant deterioration of the health status, the wellness, and the basic infrastructure of people living in Gaza right now. Basically, it's on the verge of it's on the verge of anarchy to some extent, because you have two things going on right now. You have an increase in the brutal military occupation of Gaza right now, because there was nonstop shelling. You have a closing of the border route between 48 and between Gaza, where the medical and foodstuffs come in, has been completely closed. So basically people in Gaza are starving. And then you have this kind of power vacuum that's occurring right now as the transition away from the Fatah-dominated Palestinian Authority gives way to the Hamas-dominated government. So I went at a time that was kind of in transition, if you will.
And, you know, but some of those deep wounds and some of these wounds are self-inflicted in a sense, because you were telling me about seeing, you know, the UNRWA building burned down.
Yeah.
A lot of the foreigners, and some of them are the ones that go in to help the Palestinians, have left.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I just near where I was staying is the UN social building. It was completely burned down. Just a few blocks away from that is the European Commission building in Gaza. That, too, was burned down. There is such distaste, if you will, for any kind of foreign occupation in Gaza right now, that buildings like that have taken a hit. And also there have been...
It's unfortunate, though. I mean, you know, the UNRWA has been there for years trying to help the Palestinians, but I think...
It's a mixed blessing. We know that, right?
Well, I'm trying to say perhaps people there are now at the point that they're so desperate they don't differentiate any longer between good and bad. You know,
I wouldn't say desperate. I would say there's a kind of political consciousness that, you know, you see developing, you know, and it's not just in Gaza, it's also in, you know, in West Bank, is that the colonial powers, however benevolent they may appear in the form of the United Nations or certain NGOs, are there to serve a particular purpose that is not in the best interests of Palestinians. And we can make a very cogent analysis, if you will, about the role of the UN in Palestine since 1948. You could make a very good argument, and I've seen this since, and especially in Gaza, is not necessarily a positive benefit, because in Jabalia camp, for example, which is the largest refugee camp in the world, you have 90,000 people living in an area of about, you know, 4 square kilometers.
For how many years?
For, you know, 58 years right now.
So, you know, just to remind our listeners, those are the longest standing
refugees in the world. Yeah, it's going on 58 years. You have 90,000 people living in a 4 square kilometer area. It's the most densely populated area on the planet. And within that, you have 2 health clinics, you know, that are staffed by United Nations physicians. They work 6 days a week, 6 hours a day. They see 300 to 400 patients a day. And the density and the ratio of doctor to patient is so out of whack. Like in San Francisco, for example, we have, you know, the largest density of doctors to the population of anyone. There's like 10 doctors for every 1,000 people in San Francisco.
And we complain. We don't
and,
like
and,
it.
And we complain. But when you see the health deterioration, I mean, the original question you asked me was the significant changes in what's been happening. The conditions are significantly worse.
You're listening to Arab Talk on KPOO 89.5 FM. We're talking to my brother here, Dr. Jess Ghannam, updating us on his last trip to Gaza. And when we come back, I want to learn more about how were you treated when you got there.
Oh, yeah. That'll be fun.
Welcome back to Arab Talk on KPOO 89.5 FM, and we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking to Dr. Jess Ghannam, updating us on his last visit to Gaza and the West Bank. So you took your flight from New York, San Francisco, New York, and then you arrived to Ben-Gurion Airport.
Very beautiful Ben-Gurion Airport.
And, which was established...
stolen land.
In Palestine.
Yeah.
And its name is the Lod Airport.
It's really the Lod Airport. And, you know, most listeners don't understand that it's on Palestinian land that was stolen.
So they welcomed you. They said, welcome, Dr. Justin. welcome to Ben-Gurion.
No, that's actually not what happened, Jamal, because unfortunately, what happens as a Palestinian.
Yeah, but you're an American doctor going there for humanitarian reasons. Welcome, right?
No, there's no welcome, and there's no red carpet for Palestinians. And I think, you know, most Americans don't realize that when a Palestinian, even if he or she has an American passport, is an American citizen, once you are in what is referred to as Israel, once you're there, you're treated as a Palestinian. You're not treated as an American citizen. So as I'm coming off the plane, you see something very interesting.
So you got a special card.
I got the special card.
Was it yellow, blue, or red?
It was white.
It was this time white.
No. But even before you go to passport control, even before you get there.
I just want to draw the picture.
You should draw the picture.
For our listeners. We are not on TV. There are no cameras, no pictures. So you know, people got to understand and imagine they're coming to SFO. So now...
So you're at SFO. You're coming off the plane.
And you're one out of 400 passengers.
432.
That get pulled.
And I'm pulled off the plane.
Okay.
I'm not allowed to go directly from the plane to check my bags or go through passport control. I'm pulled off the plane early, and I get asked a series of questions.
Okay.
What are you doing here? What is the purpose of your visit? Do you have any family here? What are you doing here? Where are you staying? Why are you here? On and on and on. And
someone going to their ancestral homeland. So imagine if I return to San Francisco, and this is, you know, as a San Franciscan, somebody that grew up in San Francisco.
Yeah, yeah.
Their father grew up in, you know, in here, their grandparents, and then this is the treatment you receive.
Yeah, I can't say it's the most welcoming treatment in the world, but that process, you know, is very dehumanizing. It's clearly based
racist.
Yeah, it's clearly racist. Okay. I mean, if you look at that, I mean, it's clearly a racist ideology. They see this brown man coming off the plane, you know, by himself. What are they going to do? Of course, they're going to pull me aside. They open my passport. They say, "Oh, what kind of name is that?" I said, "You know, it's a Palestinian name. What do you think?" They're playing stupid. Obviously,
yeah.
They know exactly what's going on. And there's a whole kind of this is not even in the airport yet. This is just coming off the plane, man. So that goes on for X number of minutes, and then you proceed to passport control. At passport control, you're given one of two pieces of paper. You're given either a blue piece of paper, which allows you to pass freely, mm-hmm. pass the next.
They change them, actually.
Yeah, yeah. They change the colors.
This time happened to be blue.
It happened to be blue or blue-green.
Yeah.
And if you get the blue, green-blue card, you go freely past the security and you get your bags. Me, on the other hand, I get the white card.
Mm-hmm.
The white card is the badge of honor. It's the scarlet letter. It says O on it. I don't know what the O is for. And at that point, I'm interrogated yet again. Yet again. What is the purpose of your visit? What are you doing here? Well, can we see some ID? You say you're a doctor. You blah, blah, blah. Back and forth, back and forth. And that is done 3 or 4 and 5 times because it's done by people.
And the humiliating part is that this is your homeland.
It's my home.
And then you see all these folks coming from England, France, and they're happy with their children, you know, tourists, and they're welcome to Israel.
No, it's actually very freaky. It's very, very, makes you very angry.
And then everyone stares at you because I remember I've been through this when they pull you on the side and then you see, actually, one of the funniest thing for me was when I had a long conversation one time with someone coming, you know, from I think Holland, yeah. I just was talking and he said, this is my first trip there. What do you know? I said, I'm from Jerusalem. And I told him the best sites, how to go to get to the sepulcher, what to see and what not, you know. And we had a very friendly conversation. And then
in the airport,
when he passed by me, you know, he was really shocked. They stared at you like as if I was smuggling drugs,
yeah, that's
or
what
a
it
criminal
is.
Or whatever, you know.
Yeah, everybody does look at you. You stand out like a sore thumb, because what happens as you're given this scarlet letter and you go to the next security checkpoint, all these people are walking by, most of whom are Americans, by the way, and they see that you're pulled aside with 5 or 6 other security, and they're grilling you with questions, grilling and grilling and grilling. And so for most people on the planet, you go, you have your passport, you land at the airport, you go freely. Not for a Palestinian visiting his own home. It's just not the case for us. The breadth and depth, Jamal, of the racism, the institutional, state-sponsored, structural racism that this occupation of our land is engaged in is just unbelievable. It's almost hard to imagine. I think it's hard for our listeners to imagine how deep this racism is.
It starts. This is what I'm trying to explain to people. It starts from the minute you walk in. You land in the country. The last time when I was interrogated, the person that was interrogating me with perfect American English, guess where from he was?
I don't know.
From Manhattan Beach. From Manhattan Beach. Anyway, but I want to also explain to our listeners, then that's not the end of it.
No, it's not.
Then you get out. Once you get out, after an hour or two or whatever it takes.
4 hours.
You know, 4 hours. And now, and because of the closures, usually I'm met with by my friends. Giving
no
me
way.
Like,
no
so
way.
So now you have a whole new hurdle. Now you have to take a taxi.
Yeah, it's a taxi.
And you have to take a taxi. And in my case, when I want to go visit my family in Jerusalem, And, of course, you know, now they divided Jerusalem east and west. So in East Jerusalem, to me, it's always
it's
one
city. It's just Jerusalem, man.
But once they know the address is where the Palestinians live, they refuse to take you.
Yeah, they've done that with me,
so,
too, yeah.
So you go, you sit there, and it reminds me of the racism that I came into when I first arrived into this country in New York City, when African Americans would stop a taxi and try to go to Harlem, and the cab drivers won't take them there. But this is the same thing.
So no, it's exactly the same thing.
So when I give them the address in Jerusalem, you know the best what they will do to me?
They'll leave you at the Bab el-Sham?
They'll leave you at
Jaffa Gate
Street, which means you have to walk for an additional on foot, carrying your bags for about 4 or 5 miles before you get to where you wanted to get.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or unless, and if you're lucky, a Palestinian is driving and you hail them and they, you know, they give you a ride, which they usually do. If you know, but in my case, one time I arrived at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh man!
And I had to drag my bags and walk for an hour and a half before I got to my parents' house.
Well, you know, and you're right, Jamel, because it doesn't stop there, because now it's an hour and a half. You know, from the airport, it's about an hour. Hour and a half to the Erez crossing, which is where I go in. It's completely desolate. And there's a whole series of interrogations that go on there, too. It was really stark, Jamel.
Let's stop. I'm going to stop you here before we go into yeah. Erez and take a short musical break. You're listening to KPOO 89.5 FM, Arab Talk in the House.
We're in the house.
Welcome back. You're listening to Arab Talk on KPOO 89.5 FM. So, Dr. J, now you finally found a cab.
That wasn't easy.
And that wasn't easy.
You know, because Israelis won't pick me up.
And
they won't. I mean, you know.
So who took you to Gaza?
Well, I think it's important to realize, I mean, the kind of breadth and the depth of this society, of Israeli society, because going up and finding an Israeli cab, they look at you and they see that you're Arab. They're not going to drive you. I've been turned down so many times. I've been turned down in hotels in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, Jamel, because I'm Palestinian. They won't let me stay there. So I had to be picked up by a Palestinian who had Israeli citizenship.
So you were one of the lucky ones.
I got lucky because it was a Palestinian living in Ramleh, who happens to, you know, be one of the 1.4 million Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship. And he has the special license plates because, you know, it is an apartheid society. They have special license plates for the good people and other colors of license plates for the, you know, for the slaves. There's master license plates and slave license plates. And then I was able to go to Gaza, a few checkpoints on the way to Gaza, of course. And then once you get to Erez, I mean, again, we're using the word checkpoint, Jamel, but it's not a checkpoint. It's a border crossing.
Well, actually, I want to jump a little bit because
sure.
Recently I got some new pictures from the Kalandia checkpoint.
Unbelievable.
Which now—
Between Ramallah and Jerusalem.
Between Ramallah and Jerusalem has become an international border.
It is.
It has been constructed, cameras, turnstiles—
Scanning machines,
places where you put your bags, and I've been there. I've done a documentary all over that area. But now, I mean, if you look at it, you're looking at something that has been constructed for the long haul.
This is the long haul.
I mean, a checkpoint is a temporary thing.
These are not checkpoints, Jamel. I mean, I think, again, this is something that our listening community needs to understand. These are not little checkpoints with a few Israeli soldiers, you know, frisking Palestinians as we go by. These are border crossings.
No, I call them apartheid gates.
Yeah, they're gates. I mean, when you go to the Erez crossing, you'll see a fortified, it's a fortress. It's literally a fortress. There is a passageway to go from the Israeli side through to the Palestinian checkpoint side. And you've been there, you know this. It's about a mile long. And on one side is a 20-foot high wall. On the other side is a 20-foot high wall. And you literally feel like you're back in apartheid South Africa. It's really extraordinary.
What's the size of Gaza?
Gaza is about 26 kilometers long and about 7 kilometers wide. It's very
so, you know San Francisco, what they call it, 8 by 8 mile city.
Oh yeah, this is Gaza is like infinitely smaller.
With 750,000 people.
Yeah, and Gaza has 1.6 million people. You know, it's densely populated, and you know, people made such a big deal of the Gaza withdrawal. There are no more settlers in Gaza right now, but this is a point that I have to make. And because the last time I went, the withdrawal of the settlers, the illegal settlers, had just happened. So it's been about 5 months. The quality of life has decreased substantially for Palestinians since the withdrawal. So, you know, and the Israeli media have trumpeted, oh, we got rid of the settlers from Gaza. You know, things are so much better. Things are much worse in Gaza now. The healthcare system is on the verge of collapse. There are food shortages. Children now have to live on less than $2 a day. There is malnutrition in Gaza. There is a blockade on medical supplies coming into the Gaza Strip. And there's literally a flour shortage in the outlying areas of the Gaza Strip. So life is appreciably different. And what is happening is that the Israelis and the Americans, through strangling Palestinians in Gaza, are trying to impose a political will on the newly formed Hamas government. They're basically going to say, you do business the way we're going to tell you to do business, or we're going to squeeze you with denying you food, denying you medicine, and denying you money. It's political extortion. I mean, that's basically what it is.
Who's in control in Gaza?
Well, my brother, as it turns out right now, nobody is in control in Gaza.
So that's a total mayhem?
It's we talked about this a little off the air. On every street corner, there's different armed factions, you know, representing different political groups in our community and things like that. There is not a rule of law. This is a vacuum, a political vacuum right now, as the Fatah-dominated Palestinian Authority kind of moves out and the Hamas-dominated parliament kind of moves in. So we're in a period of transition right now, and that transition is not being filled by the rule of law. Everybody has guns. There were a number, you know, large number of gunfights, you know, while I was there. And, you know, it's
erupting over territory control.
Yeah, erupting over territorial control, erupting over differences, erupting over political differences, over disputes and things like that. So it was very, very intense. And I'd say this is precisely what the American-Israeli political axis, if you will, would prefer. I mean, they're creating the conditions in Iraq, for example, for people to fight each other, obviously, and to have that country be destabilized. They are preferring and trying to do the same thing in the Gaza Strip. There is a there's two ideas about this, but one is to create the conditions so that the Hamas government will never be successful.
Interesting, you draw the parallel with Iraq, because this morning I watched the president speaking at the World Affairs Council. I don't know which state was he, but he was addressing the crowd there. And guess what? He was, like, talking about the condition, the security. For the first time, he said maybe not. We're on the verge of the civil war. And then all of a sudden, he started talking about Saddam regime, putting the blame on Saddam. And he said, you know what? All this fighting is because Saddam created that. I was like,
unbelievable.
Here we are. The U.S. is in control for the past 3 years, and he was blaming the sectarian violence on the Saddam era because he said they encouraged to do that. You know, excuse me. I think I remember then when the Americans came there, they encouraged that sectarian taking sides. You know, let's side up with the Kurds against the Turkmen, and let's side up with the Shiites against the Sunnis.
But that's not that dissimilar, Jamal. I mean, you know, you could easily make the argument that because it's impossible for the American and Israeli military presence in the Arab world right now, it's impossible for them to win militarily. We know that. And that the only way that they can extend their political and global interest there is by keeping Palestine, Iraq, and the rest of the Arab world destabilized. And you see it in Iraq, and I think you see it in Palestine, because it's clear that there's still influence from the United States. that is saying to the former ruling, you know, PA folks, the Fatah people, you know, you should not be part of this Palestinian parliament, even though it's a duly elected democratic, you know, so on and so forth.
So divide and rule.
Divide and rule, divide and conquer. That's exactly what's going on.
So you're in Gaza, and I spoke to you when you were in Gaza. You gave us an update. Now entering there is easier than getting out.
Oh, getting out is like, I'm a little worried, Jamal. I got scanned so many times. I think I might have gotten radiation poisoning. I mean, getting out is just outrageously difficult, and it's not as simple as just leaving. You have to go through a series of checkpoints, a series of gates, a series of body scans. Your luggage has to be scanned numerous times. You go through a whole series of dehumanizing and humiliating steps to leave your own home, to leave your own country.
But that's, again, you know, you are considered one of the lucky ones because you have a U.S. passport. You have medical credentials. You're on a humanitarian mission.
But no one was leaving. I'm telling you, I was the only one who left. There's no one leaving.
But they will not allow people from Gaza to leave.
It's impossible for Palestinians who don't have American passport or other kind of international passport to leave Gaza. It is impossible. There are Palestinians right now, Jamal. The cancer rate in Gaza is one of the highest cancer rates in the world. The Israelis are not letting chemotherapies in or any kind of medical supplies freely into Gaza. There are Palestinians who have leukemia, who have breast cancer, who have lung cancer. Cancers of all kinds are trying to leave Gaza and get humanitarian chemotherapy, who are being denied. And the last time you and I were there, or the last time I was there in November, I remember talking on the show about the hundreds of Palestinians that I saw at the Erez crossing who were sick and, you know, obviously had cancer and were trying to get out to get the chemotherapy. There is nobody at the Erez crossing now. There are no Palestinians. There is nobody at the Erez crossing. Basically, Gaza, Jamal, is on lockdown. It is complete lockdown right now. The Rafah crossing gets closed significantly. There's the Karni crossing, which is where medicine and food comes in. That's closed. I just saw a press release from the Al-Mezen Center, who's making a petition to the International Court in The Hague demanding that the government of Israel open up the border so that humanitarian food and medicine can be let in. It's clearly a crisis situation. I mean, every time I go there, Jamal, I say, I can't believe that it's going to get worse, and it gets worse.
How are the people coping? I mean, how, you know, the average person, food, medicine, shelter, what can they do?
Okay, well, that's the other side of it, because at the same time all of that is happening, you have the contradiction, which is all of our community that I was able to speak with and interact with, and I had a chance to speak with a wide cross-section of Palestinians in Gaza who are part of all the different political factions, all socioeconomic strata, and every single one of them greeted me with a smile, invited me into their homes, fed me beautifully, I might add. It was, and the sense of community, and, you know, in Arabic we have that word samud, steadfastness, is incredible. I had more than one Palestinian tell me, I would rather die with dignity than submit to this form of extortion, of trying to get us as Palestinians to give up our dream of freedom and self-determination.
Amazing. Well, you've been listening to an update from my co-host, Dr. Jessica Nam. Unfortunately, we're running out of time.
So, Black People
to Arab Talk.
We have a few for listening.
Talk to you next week.